afternoon. Wow. Good afternoon. There we go. Well, excellent. Thank you very much for coming along after lunch for a deep dive session, perhaps the deepest you've had, Advanced PowerShell Extreme Edition. Now, we're going to go through a lot of the new... I'm kidding. It's software-defined networking. I always like to play a bit of it. Get people warmed up. So, in this session, I'm going to take you through some of the new capabilities, the new cool stuff that's in Windows Server 2016 around networking, software-defined networking, our innovation we're building in the next release of the product. For those that don't know me, I'm Matt McSpirit. I'm a technical evangelist for our data center technology. And if you're not sure what that is, well, I essentially get to talk to lovely people like yourselves about cool technology like Windows Server storage, networking, virtualization, Azure Pack, Azure Stack, loads of cool stuff like that. But I don't have the added responsibility of needing to know how it's licensed. So that's a win for me. So I just focus on the tech. And today we've got a jam-packed agenda. I want to bring you up to speed with where we've been so far in software-defined networking in Windows Server. So focusing on perhaps the last release mainly and weaving in where we're going in the new release. And it's all very foundational stuff in terms of setting us up for the new features. If I just blast through the new stuff, you won't have real context about how the foundational stuff works. And software-defined networking is confusing at the best of times. So together, we'll get through it. I've got some demos that'll help us illustrate some of this new stuff and existing stuff blended together. So really, by the end of the session, you'll have a good appreciation of just what we're doing in the next release. We're going to look at things like cloud scale fundamentals. What are we doing in the platform? How are we working closely with hardware vendors who make the NICs and other key components that sit around our network infrastructure? How are we better working with those to integrate and drive higher levels of performance for the next generation of network infrastructure in the data center? And we call that cloud scale because we're taking a lot of these learnings and a lot of innovation from our experiences running workloads in Azure. It really sets us up to learn a huge amount to operate a data center at that kind of scale where there's tens of thousands of changes happening daily and customers are expecting the highest levels of performance and scale from their workloads. So it's important that we learn from that and bring it on premises where people can benefit from it in their data centers. We'll look at SDN infrastructure, so network virtualization, some of the other key components of that, some of the new network function virtualization capabilities. You think, what is a network function? What is network function virtualization when it's at home? Well, essentially, think of this as taking the things around the network that you would typically have as appliances, perhaps, maybe hardware-based, like a load balancer or a firewall or some kind of site-to-site VPN gateway. Typically, you buy those as hardware appliances. We're talking about virtualizing those as appliances. Those are virtualized network functions. And so we're going to talk a little bit about some of the ones that ship in the box for Microsoft in Windows Server 2016 and how we integrate with third parties as well. And then I'll give you some resources and stuff as well to wrap up. So when we think about the story so far, I'm going to build this up in a series of layers so we all get on the same page. There was a lot of innovation that went into Hyper-V in 2012 and even more in 2012 R2, just at that Hyper-V host level, that really enabled you to drive great levels of performance for your virtual workloads, provide fantastic connectivity between your Hyper-V host and your back-end storage, particularly if you were using SMB-based storage, so server message block to our file server back-end. But there was also a lot of work done where we coordinated with partners to drive improved performance around hardware offloads and convergence. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on convergence in the next couple of slides. But at a high level, there was a lot done around Hyper-V and the host layer. But then we get into physical switches that connect your hosts with the rest of your infrastructure. And you might not know, but Microsoft with OMI has got a lot of integration through our systems management tools that enable you to start to manage your physical switches in conjunction with your Hyper-V hosts and your virtual networks. So in particular, System Center Virtual Machine Manager, our management tool for our Hyper-V hosts, really allows you to start to apply policies to these switches in a standardized way that enables you to bring about change from that one single console, rather than going to the Arista console or the insert vendor here console to make that change. And this isn't just a Microsoft thing, this is something we've worked with network vendors on to help standardize, and we'll learn a bit more about that as we go forward. But then above that, this is where it starts to get into this virtualization realm, specifically around virtual networks. utilizing something called NVGRE, Network Virtualization Generic Route Encapsulation, or route if you prefer. And this is essentially our encapsulation of key workloads that you're virtualizing and isolating them from one another. So as the slide depicts, you've got a set of blue virtual machines, a set of red virtual machines. We're not isolating those with VLANs anymore. That's old for us. We're moving forward with software-defined networks utilizing the network virtualization GRE to encapsulate and isolate those red and blue VMs. And the beauty of network virtualization is those red and blue VMs can float across the data center anywhere they like, but they're always going to be able to communicate with their respective peers within their virtual networks. And you'll see when I demo shortly, I'll show you how easy it is to actually spin up some of these virtual networks. And you'll see, compared to going to a switch, making configuration changes, ensuring that doesn't disconnect anything else, making sure all of the appropriate aggregation switches are all configured optimally, I don't have to do any of that, because software-defined networking allows me to just do it in a couple of clicks in something like System Center. So we'll have a look at that as well. And then finally, these software-defined networks, these virtual networks, they need to be able to communicate out to the internet. Well, maybe they don't. Maybe they don't in your environment. But in many cases, they need to be able to escape out of their virtual networks to communicate with non-virtualized stuff. Imagine if the red VMs there were your company's Exchange servers and your laptops, who've got Outlook installed. How do they get to their mail servers? If my laptop knows nothing about network virtualization, we need some kind of bridge between the virtualized networks and the non-virtualized networks. And that's where these gateways come in. And we actually made available a Windows Server Gateway as part of Windows Server 2012 R2 as a core piece of functionality, essentially an improvement and an extension of what was RRAS, so enabled you to bridge the virtualized networks and none. And that was built into the product. And we'll talk a bit more about those as we go forward. So there are core building blocks that are essentially where we are today with 2012 R2. And if we drill in a little bit more depth into some of these, so Hyper-V, what is the extensible switch? Well, this is important because this is a pivotal part, and it is now in 2012 R2 and going forward in 2016 even more so. This is how your VMs communicate out of the hosts, out of your Hyper-V hosts. And the fact it's called extensible should lead you to understand that it's extensible through partners. Partners can extend the functionality and plug in to drive additional functionality. So partners like Cisco, Five9, NEC, Inmon are just four examples of partners who've written plugins for our switch that enable them to provide specific functionality. So if you're a Cisco shop and you use, for instance, the Nexus 1000V, supported on Hyper-V, plugs into our extensible switch. That's very different from earlier releases of Hyper-V where it was a very closed switch and you couldn't extend in any way. And that extensible switch, very powerful, very high performance, gets even more high performance in the next release of 2016, but it enables those VMs to communicate out. And aside from that, NIC teaming. Anybody who used Hyper-V in the early days, 2008, 2008 R2, NIC teaming was, it caused a little bit of pain. It wasn't in-box. It wasn't something we supplied. We relied on you to utilize the NIC teaming utilities and drivers of the vendors who made your NICs. So you would go to Broadcom or HP or Intel or whoever it may be, install their relevant NIC teaming software, which may or may not have been tested with Hyper-V, and then create your team and then bind your vSwitch to that, and VMs may or may not be able to communicate after the fact. And if anything went wrong, the general supported guidance was, well, remove the team and start again and create your vSwitch that way. And that wasn't necessarily the best supported story. Thankfully, in 2012 and enhanced in 2012 R2, NIC teaming became in the box. It was in the box in Windows Server. Nice, slick UI, controllable through PowerShell as well. Streamlined, 32 NICs per team, mixed NICs, mixed vendors, fine, complete flexibility, which was a big plus, and it was all supported by Microsoft. So things really took a big step in the right direction. Then we think about connecting to storage, and I'm going to bring these two bullets up one after the other, or together. If you're using Hyper-V and you're connecting it to our backend storage using SMB, so Server Message Block 3.0, or 3.1.1, I think is the latest now, with 2016, you're essentially able to utilize multiple channels, so multiple paths, just like you would with the SAN if you had MPIO. So SMB multi-channel, multiple paths from your Hyper-V host to your backend SMB-based storage. Great performance boost and resilient because there's multiple channels, multiple paths, without the need to use teaming. But then SMB Direct gets you the increased performance. So there's a lot of industry drive out there with our network vendors, particularly those who are utilizing, or like the likes of Mellanox, Chelsea, Broadcom are pushing forward with this as well, to provide what are known as RDMA capabilities, remote device memory access. And RDMA is a technology that's embedded within these NICs. You find it in InfiniBand NICs or iWarp NICs. And essentially it is a technology that utilizes a buffer on the NICs between the sender and the receiver to enable you to essentially streamline the stack, the TCP IP stack so much that the speed at which you can transfer data across the network between these two RDMA-capable NICs is phenomenally accelerated. And I'll give you some context about how fast. In our test labs, in the Hyper-V team, they connected a couple of Hyper-V hosts up with RDMA NICs, 56 gig NICs, and 100 gig are on the horizon, but they use 56 gig. And they ran a couple of virtual machines on these hosts, and they started live migrating the virtual machines. And live migration generates a decent amount of traffic when you're traversing the network there. And they specifically said, use the SMB Direct network for this traffic. They were migrating VMs so quick that the bottleneck of the migration wasn't the RDMA NICs, it wasn't the storage, it wasn't the CPU, but it was the memory of the servers couldn't keep up with how fast you were transferring these VMs from one to another. And that's how fast RDMA NICs can be. They're just incredible performance. So whether you're using them for transferring live migration traffic or connecting your Hyper-V host to the back-end storage, SMB Direct is incredibly important. And you think, well, why are you telling us this? Well, why is it important? If you're weighing up hardware decisions going forward about the next generation of your servers and infrastructure, even if you're not planning to use it today, make sure you just check that box to say, yeah, I need NICs that have got RDMA capability, because it's going to be a big deal. It's going to be important. So Hyper-V will take advantage of it, and I'm sure there'll be other platforms as well. And we'll talk more about RDMA later on as well. And then finally, hardware offloads. So aside from RDMA, which I suppose itself is a hardware capability that we integrate with, there are others like VMQ, VRSS, to really ensure that you can drive the highest levels of network traffic, not only through the physical host, but to the VMs as well. VRSS is a relatively new one that was in 2012. So if you've got a multi-processor VM that needs to drive a lot of network traffic, maybe it's some kind of appliance, maybe it's a Linux appliance that you're using for network traffic monitoring or something. It's got to handle a lot of traffic. Having multiple cores and having VRSS, virtual receive side scaling in that VM, enables you to handle that intense amount of traffic by spreading the processing of the traffic across multiple processors. Without VRSS or on the physical world RSS, it focuses in on a single core, and it can be the bottleneck. So you can't get to the higher network speeds. So this is some of the innovation that we've built in at the host layer. And this will traverse into 2016 as well. But I wanted to talk about some deployment architectures and examples and also some best practices as we go forward. Because converged networking is becoming more and more prevalent. It's something that's on a lot of organizations' minds about how we can reduce the complexity in our data center. This should be common to, I guess, a lot of people who've got perhaps servers of 3 or 4, maybe even slightly older, where you've gone and bought a server, you've got 4 ports on board, you've added another quad port NIC, you've added another quad port NIC because this is going to be a virtualization host, and all of a sudden you've got 12 1 gig NICs in this host, and you've got 20 of these. That's a lot of cables, quite a few switches. It could be a bit of a spaghetti mess behind the servers, depending on how regimented you are about your wires and your cabling and whether you do tack them up and all that stuff. I do, but it takes a long time when you've got a lot of servers like this. But what would a common deployment for a virtualization host look like for Hyper-V? Well, a traditional one, in this respect, you team multiple NICs. So you team the first two on the left, then the next two. And the reason you team these is because, ideally, you need separate networks for the different types of traffic around a Hyper-V host. So you need management traffic, isolated from cluster traffic, isolated from live migration traffic, storage traffic. Possibly you might be using a fiber channel, in which case you wouldn't need the extra NICs for that. And you need traffic NICs that are for your VMs. So you'll see I created 4 teams in this case, T1, T2, T3, and T4, to reflect those different types of traffic. I didn't do storage. I assumed that would be handled elsewhere, maybe fiber channel or whatever, but at least in this respect, 4. And you'll see T4, I grouped 4 NICs, and I bound a Hyper-V switch to that, and that allows my virtual machines to communicate out. But the key takeaway here is lots of cables, lots of switches potentially, lots of ports, and at the end of the day, still only reasonable bandwidth, because you've still only got 12 gig of bandwidth there across all of that. I mean, assuming you use all 12. If you don't, then you've got less, obviously. Going forward, however, a more prevalent approach we're seeing, and certainly Microsoft is starting to recommend, and if you know our cloud platform system, our systems are starting to ship like this as well. Going down to a pair of NICs, two NICs, 10 gig, loads of bandwidth, plenty of availability there for the flow of traffic. We team it, so we've got 20 gig of available bandwidth, we bind a vSwitch, and then our VMs can communicate out of that. But you think, well, how does the host communicate out of that? Well, this is where we create, essentially, host vNICs as well, using PowerShell or using System Center. So we're essentially defining those separated networks we need, but we're doing it in software. So we create a host vNIC for management, a host vNIC for cluster, a host vNIC for live migration. So we're separating the traffic types we need. We're giving them different IP addresses on different subnets, maybe even different VLANs if you prefer. But all in all, they're sharing across all of those different network types, they're sharing the 20 gig of bandwidth. But we still only have two cables coming out of that server. So much more efficient, we're managing it through software. And we think, okay, how do we separate, how do we give the live migration network enough resource compared to the cluster network, which only really needs to be a heartbeat network? How do we allocate bandwidth more efficiently from our 20 gig of available bandwidth? And that's where we use things like Quoz, either in software or in hardware. Now, like I said, host vNICs can be on different VLANs, that's fine. You'll see that the Quoz policy, very easy to establish. And again, it can all be delivered by System Center. So certainly, if you were thinking, going forward, what should my approach be? Think about those reduced number of NICs. Think about utilizing 10 gig. It's not as expensive as it used to be. And if you weighed up a couple of 10 gig NICs per server versus 12 ports of 1 gig and all the extra switches you might need, you might find that it's actually less expensive than the equivalent gigabit. And you get in an additional bandwidth as well. But make sure that those NICs are RDMA capable. That would be, because we'll get to, like I say, we'll get to RDMA later on. In fact, we'll get to it now. I did prepare these slides. So where RDMA fits in, RDMA, as I said, is going to give us extremely fast and accelerated performance for the network. The additional benefit is the processing is done on the NIC itself, so the host processors feel less of a burden. The problem with RDMA, with 2012 R2, is that it doesn't support teaming, and it doesn't support being bound to a vSwitch. Therefore, I would lose that RDMA capability and advantage. So if you're thinking, okay, today on 2012 R2, how would I embrace RDMA? Well, you'd utilize a couple of RDMA NICs on your host, a couple of 10 gig NICs that you would dedicate to the VM traffic. Seems like overkill, but it depends on your how busy your VMs are from a network perspective. And that's how you would go about it. And you say, well, I haven't got those five types of traffic, the live migration, the cluster, the storage. You haven't separated those out. Where are they here? And that's where you use something called data center bridging, a form of Quoz, if you will, to define policies that separate the traffic. So that host still only has a couple of IPs assigned on RDMA NIC 1 and RDMA NIC 2. That's fine. But we utilize the DCB policies to say, okay, traffic of type live migration, give this amount of bandwidth. Traffic of type SMB, give this amount of bandwidth. So we do it in DCB in conjunction with the hardware. And generally, most 10 gig NICs have DCB capability built in anyway. Make sure your firmware and your drivers are the most up-to-date, though, just to make sure. So that's a challenge, because this is overkill. We don't necessarily need to give 20 gig to the host and 20 gig to VMs. It seems a little bit much. Is there anything we can do to essentially converge that still further and have a model that's a little bit more like what we saw on the previous slide with just two 10 gig NICs? The answer is yes, and I'll talk about it later because we've cracked it in 2016. So as I said, yep, they can use the RDMA. We've got dedicated 10 gig NICs. I don't need to go through this again. That's how you would define the traffic class again. So new NetQuoz, traffic class in PowerShell, and then you set your bandwidth appropriately. It's that easy. Now, there is another acronym on there, ROCE, ROCE, as some people refer to it as. This is actually what I call a nested acronym, because it stands for RDMA over converged Ethernet. So ROCE, RDMA over converged Ethernet. And that's Broadcom make a lot of NICs that have ROCE capability. And that is essentially a type of RDMA protocol that you need to do some extra configuration on your switch. PFC stands for Priority Flow Control. So you just need to be aware of that if you are using that. If you're using InfiniBand or you're using iWarp, you wouldn't need to worry about either of those. So that's a little bit about the host and some of the other components, but switch management. Well, this is all around OMI. So this isn't something I said Microsoft, as I said before, Microsoft is just doing on their own. This is something where we're enabling a more programmatic control in a standardized manner across physical switch infrastructure. So WSMAN, SIM, utilizing WMI V2, the things that our developers, our partners are working with. And so we're all standardizing against this, which means I've essentially abstracted my physical switches. I can more easily define what I need them to do centrally in a more standardized manner using my familiar tools, whether that's PowerShell, whether that's tools like System Center Virtual Machine Manager, or third-party tools if you prefer. It just means that if I am running a mixed infrastructure where I've got switches from different vendors, I can get them on the same page more easily and control and manage them more efficiently without having to rely on the specialist skill sets or going back to the manual for that. So this standardization really helps, particularly as we move towards a software-defined network infrastructure. And that allows us to automate. And then virtual networking. I'll show you this in a bit more detail in a demo. But there are a couple of big benefits. But firstly, what is network virtualization? It's an overlay. It's essentially a way for me to isolate key workloads that are within these virtualized networks, do it all through software, and not need to rely on VLANs. Because not all switches go beyond 1,000 VLANs, which in service providers is already a bottleneck. And VLANs become cumbersome and complex and take time to configure from a manual perspective. If you're thinking, okay, I want to enable the most flexibility in my data center, when it comes to VLANs, if you've got servers across multiple racks, you have to ensure that if I want a VM that's on rack 1 and server A to communicate with a VM that's in rack 10 with server B, that the VLANs connecting all of those across the different ports, across the aggregation switches, top of rack, and so on, are all lined up and they can communicate. Because one little wrong assigned VLAN and everything can go to pot. But with software-defined networks, we're essentially able to flatten the physical network, simplify considerably. So in my example, my four Hyper-V hosts that are grayed out at the moment, imagine they're just statically assigned on a routable network, and we utilize that path that links them all, that pipe that links all of these, we utilize that as our tunnel that we use for our virtual networks. So when those blue virtual machines are scattered across our physical hosts, rightly so, because we just want them to float, they can communicate over that physical network, yet their traffic is encapsulated with NVGRE. And it enables us to be very flexible. We don't have to worry about assigning VLANs. I'll show you how easy it is to define virtual networks in a minute. It gives us complete mobility. Because I can define virtual networks so quickly and so easily and connect them across my data centers, so they essentially stretch. So if I wanted to move a VM from Sydney to Brisbane across our two data centers, I could have a virtual network that spans the whole of those two data centers. And I could very easily move them, live migrate them across. Even if the physical networks have different subnets across different IP schemes, that's fine. As long as they're routable, I can live migrate my VMs across those boundaries and encapsulate them within virtual networks to still enable them to communicate. And you'll see how easy it is for me to do, and therefore how easy it is to automate with PowerShell. And that little bullet, it sneaks on there right at the end, this last one, but it's really important. I probably should have put it at the top. It just works with what you've got today. The hardware in my lab that you'll see, I am hand-me-down central at Microsoft. We have an alias or a discussion list on in the office, and it's called Microsoft Hardware Test Lab Managers. It's completely irrelevant to the discussion, but I'm going to give you the context anyway. And people say, oh, I'm getting rid of this piece of kit. I'm getting rid of this. I'm like, I'm on it. I need hardware. My lab is terrible. So I've just got this mishmash of stuff. But it all works with network virtualization. That's my point. So there was some kind of method to it. You don't need new switches. You don't need new servers. You don't need new NICs. Yeah, newer hardware will benefit slightly. So offloads, for instance, on newer NICs. There's network virtualization offloads that can improve performance, but it still works with my older NICs, so I'm not at a disadvantage significantly. And then finally, that gateway. This is a bridge between those virtualized worlds and none, or between the virtualized networks and the public internet, whatever it may be. It just enables me to traverse those without them being isolated islands that I can't actually interact with. And these gateways, they could be ingrained within switches from our third-party partners, or they could be an appliance, or in this case, in our case, they're built into Windows Server. So it's just a role that you can enable. In fact, we actually provide you with a template, a service template in System Center that you can deploy it. So there's quite a bit of detailed guidance on TechNet. You download the relevant bits into your System Center environment, and you deploy this service template, and it will deploy the network virtualization gateway for you. So it's pretty streamlined and available to download. Now, there's two types of gateway. There's one that is really about NAT. So you give it maybe you're a service provider, and you want to just give your tenants in the blue and the red network just a dirty link out to the internet. You're not worried about it. Just give them a link out. You want to NAT the public IPs you've got to these different tenants. And that's what the gateway can be used for in NAT mode. But it can also be used for more private cloud, enterprise type, where you just want your end users who've got no idea of network virtualization and their machines to connect to machines that are encapsulated in the virtual networks. And if that's the case, the private cloud instance of this deployment option would be the most appropriate. But there's also site-to-site and VPN capability as well built in. So that's enough chatter. Let me show you, let me just get my PC woken up. Hopefully it's probably lost its RDP connection now, so we'll have to let me flick over while it's doing that. Let's just wait for the network, ironically. So while it's doing that, what I'm going to show you, hopefully, is... Oh, it's got network. Come on, please. What I might show you, potentially show you, is how I will deploy virtual networks. We'll wait till it gets to 20 awkwardly, and then I'll figure something out. How I'm going to deploy virtual networks with System Center Virtual Machine Manager. Let me just wake this up. Oh no, this is a problem. Fortunately, I've got other demos that I can show, but I really wanted to show this one. Sad for a networking session. Let's try this one. Does anyone know anyone knows anything about networking? Right, let's try this again. It's always at times like this that I have the longest password in the world. Let's just see if I am actually connected to the internet. Oh, no, I am. Damn it. So why is that not working? All right, one last time, and then I'll move on to another demo, and I'll try and come back to this one when it's... Let's go with this option. Let's see if this one works instead. Nope. Okay, right. I'll come back to network virtualization in action in a demo a bit later on. I don't know how I'm going to carry on and try and fix my network at the same time, but I'll come back to that, and it will make sense as we go forward. Anyway, where are we going when we... with the new technologies? What's new? What's coming in? And this is where I wanted to, at least at a high level, give you an indication of what's happening, what's going on, and then we'll drill into each of these as we go forward a bit later on. So firstly, you'll notice in the top right, this thing called the network controller. This is going to be an incredibly integral part, an important part of how we define and manage our virtual network infrastructure going forward. It's incredibly important. It's a central brain of how we control and manage the network. And essentially, it's going to control a lot of different things. So in the bottom right, you see Hyper-V host. This is where we'll start to control policies like firewall, software load balancing, System Center and Hyper-V agent capabilities as well, all controlled from this network controller. On the bottom left, you'll see appliances, like the things I was referring to before. So site-to-site gateway, the software load balancer, the Hyper-V network virtualization, all of those will be controlled and defined through the network controller. And in addition, you'll also find in the middle layer all of the different service managers. And these are the different things that the network controller can do for your across those different areas, across Hyper-V hosts and across the different appliances that we're able to provide out. You'll also notice this northbound interface and this southbound interface. You say, what is that all about? What is the northbound interface? What's the southbound? Well, those are essentially the ways that we interact with the network controller. Northbound being you're using PowerShell, you're using JSON, you're using other forms of programmatic management to query, to define change, to control the network controller. So you feed in that through the REST API, through the northbound interface. That brings about change, and it executes that change in the southbound. So for instance, you might say, you might write a PowerShell script that brings about a new firewall policy that gets deployed. You hit the northbound interface, the firewall, the virtual firewall service manager says, okay, yep, I know what you mean. I'm going to apply that, and it applies it to the firewall on the Hyper-V host. So great stuff. That's all straightforward. However, what I might try and do, I might try and connect from this machine while I'm, bear with me a sec, because I really want to show you that other demo. Let's see if I can get it working very quickly. So keep that very entertaining graphic in your mind. So, and this is new in 2016. This network controller does not exist in any previous version of Windows Server. And this network controller, we'll go into more technical depth about it later on, but it's the network controller that is essentially built and designed and available for us from Azure. So it's been, again, the engineering, the effort that's gone into Azure, and that network controller that's controlling all of the key components there, which bringing it on premises, bringing it into a state where you can utilize it yourselves in your, within your environments. Let me try one more thing. I'll try and VPN back to my environment and see if I can get in that way. It was fine, 5 minutes before the, as soon as I goes to sleep, that's it, game over. But yeah, so that's the platform overview. We'll go through each of these in a few more, in a bit more detail. So starting with cloud scale fundamentals, what's that all about? Well, cloud scale fundamentals is again, what I was saying before about utilizing our innovation, our experiences that we're building in the cloud to essentially drive improvements on premises with our inbox technology, the network controller being one example. I talked about quite a few others. I mentioned software load balancer before. You're probably thinking, is he on about the NLB? He's not talking about NLB, is he? Not the NLB that's in Windows. No, please no. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about software load balancer that is in Azure that we've said, you know what, this is pretty good. People are doing all right with this software load balancer in Azure. Why don't we bring it on-prem? We're bringing those experiences on-premises into Windows Server to enable you to utilize them, which I think is a pretty good thing. So let's look at some of those. Firstly, NIC teaming, and I know I've got the demo for that right in front of me, so I know I can show you this one, and it will work. Let me give it one more go at logging in for my other environment. I'm determined to show you this network virtualization. Hang on, we could be on here. Boom! Here we go. Right, so forget everything I just told you about that platform and wind back to the point where I said, network virtualization action, let's go to a demo. So here we go. So let me give you, I built it up to give you extra context. I want to show you in this demo how easy it is for me to deploy virtualized networks, okay? We're going to look at it from the administrator's perspective, which I'm sure is most relevant to most of you. Then we're going to switch and look at it from the tenant perspective and see how they can consume. You say, well, tenant, we're not a service provider. Why do I need a tenant view? Well, think about a scenario where you've got developers in your org or people who just come to you and say, can I have a VM for something? Can I have a VM and I don't want it to connect to corp, I need to be isolated or whatever it may be. And you say, yes, okay, I'll do that for you. I'll go and create some VLANs, I'll siphon one off for you, I'll send you the email when it's done. Time wasted, and then I'll create you a VM, and then yeah, there's better things you can do with your time than that. There are more automated ways. So I want to give you that angle as well. So what we're looking at now is Virtual Machine Manager, System Center Virtual Machine Manager, Technical Preview 3. And this is essentially managing a couple of Hyper-V hosts within my infrastructure. Again, remember my mishmash of hardware. And I'm pretending to be, let's say I'm a service provider with a couple of tenants, or I could be an enterprise hosting a couple of departments, however you see fit. I've got Contoso and I've got Tailspin as two of my usually safe brand companies that I'm hosting. And these two organizations, they're very competitive. I'm hosting both their infrastructures for them as the service provider, but they cannot ever, they compete in the market, they can't, They can't essentially conflict within my environment. However, when they came to me in my to host their infrastructure, they said, well, on premises at the moment, in our respective data centers, we use the subnet 192.168.2.x. I said, okay, that's fine. Because with network virtualization, I'll just build you a virtual network that matches that, and I'll host your stuff. And so Kotoso say, yeah, great, excellent. But then Tailspin come over and say, oh, we'd like you to host our network and stuff as well, our infrastructure. Our subnet is 192.168.2.0. And you think, oh, okay, so you've got exactly the same. How am I going to do that with the environment that I've got? Well, I'll just use network virtualization. So you'll see, if I look at my VM networks view here, I've got my, if I zoom in, I've got Tailspin, and their environment is 192.168.2.0. That's their virtual network. And Contoso, you'll see I've actually given them two, one for their devs, one for their test. So they're in the 192.168.3 and .2 network. You'll say, okay, how did I create those networks? What's the process you went through? Well, it's actually really easy. So I'll create VM network. I'll call this one Ignite 001. Now, this logical network is essentially the plumbing that's connecting my Hyper-V hosts on which this virtual network is going to traverse. It's not magic. I mean, if I've got two Hyper-V hosts and I've got two VMs for Contoso, one on each host, and they want to communicate, it's got to go via a wire somehow. Virtual networks don't just magically jump between hosts. It's got to traverse that physical wire. It's just encapsulated. And that's why I choose a logical network, a network that I've defined as this pipe that network virtualization can flow along. Typically, you would isolate this network from other networks in your environment, maybe put it on a different VLAN. So I'll go next. I'm going to isolate using network virtualization. Yep, next, subnets. So Ignite, as the company that's just come in who competes with Contoso and with Tailspin, ironically, I'm going to call this one Ignite subnet, and I'm going to put it on the 192.168.2.0/24, not /245, that wouldn't work, and go next. Now remember I said about the connectivity, how you break out of these virtual networks, how you communicate off into a non-virtualized network world? I need a gateway. At this stage in the wizard, this is what it's asking me. Do you want to connect this virtual network that you're building for Ignite? Do you want to connect it to your gateway that I've already deployed? It's quite a boring process, so I didn't walk you through that. But this bit, I'm just going to choose, I could choose yes. I'm going to choose NAT, which essentially would say, okay, you use one of your public IPs, and you let this network just communicate out to the internet in this case. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to let this particular virtual network be encapsulated and enclosed and not break out in this instance. But I'll go finish. And that is how I've created a network. Dead easy. All right, and that network spans all of my Hyper-V hosts within my data center. It could be two hosts, could be 1,000 hosts. But instantly, straight across. I don't need to go to any racks or any top of rack switches, aggregation switches, done. As long as my Hyper-V host can communicate on that logical network that I defined, that I showed you a minute ago, these VMs that I put in that virtual network Ignite can go anywhere, which means I don't have to get into the situation where, well, I should really put that Ignite VM on rack one in server A because, you know, I don't really want it going over there because it's not as much capacity. I can just let the data center flow and let VMM manage all of that and balance the capacity accordingly. Now, VMM also gives us extra capability when it comes to administering and applying IP addresses. Because right now, all I've done is said that Ignite 001 network has just got this is the subnet. I need to, if I want VMM to apply IP addresses to new virtual machines that the tenants create, then I need to create what's called an IP pool. So I'm going to call this one Ignite IP pool. And I'm going to put it on, I'll go next. Here's the starting IP, the end IP, any reservations that I know I'm going to need, I can put them in as well. I can define a default gateway, DNS, WINS. I'm going to leave all of that blank. It's fine for the time being. And if I don't know if many of you use VMM, but if you haven't, this little view script button's really handy because I can generate the PowerShell that it's going to execute and I can reuse that in my automation scripts if I see fit. And it's a good learning tool. So I'll click finish. And now I've got my static IP address pool. So just like that, in a couple of clicks, I've essentially created a new network that spans my data center. I've created an IP pool, so whenever anyone deploys a VM on that network, VMM will just dish it out an IP address. I don't need to worry about a DHCP server there or statically assign it once it's done. It's just good to go, and it's that easy. And that's the administrative experience of me creating virtual networks. Really straightforward. But as I said earlier, what if I want the tenants, my tenants, to consume themselves through self-service? Well, we have a great portal that can enable us to do that, and it's called the Azure Pack. And the Azure Pack looks a bit like this. Looks a bit like the classic Azure portal from today, but this is on-premises. This is running in my data center. I've enabled this for consumption through for my tenants. And John Smith is logged in. I couldn't think of anything more original, so I just went with John Smith. He's logged in, and he's going to create a virtual network. So he's going to go through exactly the same process as I just went through as an admin, but let me show you how easy it is for him. So imagine this is your development team or whoever pesters you the most for new VMs and stuff, because I can create the VMs as well in here as well. I'm just going to concentrate on networking. But let's create a virtual network. I'm going to go custom, because I really want to show you the detailed wizard as opposed to the quick one. And I'm going to call this give me my network. I'm not going to put an exclamation mark because it'll probably break. No, it won't. There we go. Give me my network. I'm not going to do it just in case. Oh, let me go. I'll just do test, actually. There we go. Oh, you think I've bailed now. Okay, fine. Give me my network, please. So we'll go next. DNS, am I going to put a DNS server in there? Maybe I don't need to. I can add that if I want. This is where I select if I want to use NAT. Again, as we saw before, I'll go next. Now, this is where I define my IP address. So as a tenant, I might not be that bothered, so I could just select the default. It really doesn't matter. Whatever they select, it's encapsulated. So it's not going to conflict with your corporate network or anything else. They can't break out. So I'm going to just pick, I'll just pick 10. In fact, I'll do 11.11.11, and I'll do 1.1.1, because my typing's terrible. And I'll go, I'll add another one of 192.168.2.0. These are just subnets that I can use as a tenant. I'll do 192.168.5.0, and I'll change that one to something like I'll just use 23, that'll do. And that will do it, hopefully. Creating virtual network, give me my network, please. Please, yeah, there we go. I had faith, I knew it was going to do it. That's it. So now, as a tenant, I could just deploy VMs and I could select my network as part of that VM deployment and my VMs would be encapsulated and secured and not going to conflict with Contoso or Tailspin or my other Ignite network that I created. And to show you the administrative view, there's my give me my network, please. There's my give me my network. I mean, ignore the name. It's just relating to that, to the subscription that I've got in the Azure Pack that it's connected to. But you'll see we chose 1.1.1.0 by mistake. 192.168.4 and 192.168.2. They're our networks. And that is essentially a very quick view of how I create virtual networks through software. It's really easy. And those VMs could float all over the place, which is great. Right, so let me go back to my slides. So as I was talking about cloud scale fundamentals, so change direction slightly. I want to talk about some of the ways that we're changing what's going on at the Hyper-V host layer that are going to make things better in this next release. And everything I showed you in that demo was on 2016 and using Technical Preview 3 and Technical Preview 3 of Windows Server, so it's all current stuff. When you've created a NIC team today in Windows Server 2012 R2, you typically select your NICs, you go to Server Manager, you create the team, then you go to Hyper-V Manager, and you create the vSwitch, and you bind it to that team. Multiple steps, multiple layers that the traffic has to pass through. And we don't need that. We just don't need all of those layers. And that's what switch embedded teaming is all about in the next release of Windows Server. It's a new way of converging networking, and it has an additional benefit that I'll talk about shortly. The first one is it's teaming integrated into the Hyper-V vSwitch. You say, what does that mean? Well, when I create my vSwitch for my virtual machines to communicate, I can tell it I'd like to use these four NICs for this one vSwitch. And instead of me going manually creating a team and then binding the vSwitch to that, it just creates it all in one go. So the teaming functionality becomes part of the Hyper-V switch, which gives us improvement of performance, increased scale. There are load balancing capabilities similar to what we see in the normal teaming today. It's not in Virtual Machine Manager today, so you can't manage it through the UI. It has to be done through PowerShell, at least as it stands today. And I'm going to demo, I'll show you what it looks like in a minute. And unlike the regular teaming in Windows Server, which supports up to 32 NICs of mixed vendor, this is much more specific. 8 NICs per team, maximum, and they have to be the same. And for the most part, they most likely would be. But that's something to be aware of. But It's very, very straightforward. And the command to do that, new VM switch, name, give it a name, choose the NICs you want to use, and then enable embedded teaming. It's as simple as that. And I've actually, to give you a graphical representation of what that looks like compared to what we had before, we saw we had our RDMA, 10 gig NICs, the team, and then the Hyper-V vSwitch. Remember, we had to separate those because RDMA didn't support teaming, RDMA didn't support a vSwitch. But that's where things change in 2016. Because now, you'll notice in this one on the right-hand side, my Hyper-V host has just got two 10 gig NICs. They are RDMA-capable NICs, so I get that really fast performance with RDMA. I create a Hyper-V switch with switch embedded teaming, and I create my host vNICs like you saw, like I was talking about before, for my different traffic types, and I create my virtual machine and its vmNIC. Now, the significant thing there is, you said before, Matt, when you were talking about switches, that RDMA doesn't work when you bind teaming and all that stuff. That's what we've solved. In 2016, we allow you to essentially virtualize RDMA. So we're enabling you to, if you think about it, your host vNICs can now be RDMA capable, and the virtual machine vNICs could be RDMA capable as well. And then we're not talking you pass through RDMA and you get 10% of the performance of what you do in the physical world. We're talking native performance through to either the host vNICs or the VMs themselves. So it's significantly improved. It takes us down, gives us the ability to converge more successfully, and gives us new flexibility around those host and guest vNICs with RDMA. So definitely, you've heard me speak about RDMA multiple times now. It's very, very important for performance going forward. So I'll give you some background on the switch. It's just a PowerShell scripts if you want to do it, but I'll show you what it looks like in a minute. In fact, let me go to my demo now, and I'll come back for context. So here we are in my other environment, my little data center that's local, which I should have run everything from, really. Let me show you the old way first. So this is a Hyper-V host running a couple of VMs. They're not actually running. It doesn't matter for the purpose of this demonstration. But this is a Hyper-V host local that I'm on here. In Server Manager, the old way I would do things is I would go, I want to create a NIC team for my virtual machine traffic. I would go tasks, new team. I'll call this one team one. I select my NICs that I want to use, in this case, up to 32 NICs. I can define some additional properties, like whether I want it to be switch independent, static teaming, or LACP mode. The new teams, at least as it stands today, are just switch independent. I can choose a load balancing mode, how it distributes the traffic across the team. Dynamic is fine. That was newly introduced in R2, and it's probably the best one for our solution here. And whether I want all adapters active or not. And I can define a VLAN. So I'm going to go OK. And that's going to go ahead, and that's going to create that team. And once it's finished, I would then, as part two of that, I would simply go to Hyper-V Manager, and I go Virtual Switch Manager, New Virtual Switch, Test Switch, and I would bind it to that team that's not particularly friendly named there. You'll notice I uncheck this box, Allow Management OS to Share This Network Adapter. That's essentially saying, do you want to create a host vNIC that I've been talking about in multiple times so far for the host to communicate out through this vSwitch? And I don't need that because I've already got host communication through other network adapters, so I don't need that. Now, this may affect network connectivity, you think? Yes. And I'll go, OK. And that's our two-step process. Now, it's not massively cumbersome. It's very straightforward. You could do it through PowerShell as well. The key thing is that it's two layers. If I look in my network and sharing connections view here, the NICs that we used are just listed as enabled. They've had essentially their TCP IP stack removed and everything because it's just using the teaming functionality. And then we've got our team, which has actually disappeared because there it is, team one. And then you've got the vSwitch bound to it. So there's multiple layers that the traffic has to pass through there. Well, there's a better way, and that's where we use the switch embedded teaming. So I'll bring up my little PowerShell window and just run through some of these. So very easy, new VM switch. Which NICs do I want to use under the covers? So I'm using a couple of different NICs. And do I want to allow the management OS to share this NIC? And the answer is no. So I'll go run. It will go ahead and it will create that. If I go back to my network and sharing view, hopefully it should be performing that. Should be, oh, there we go. just teasing me there till I made it full screen. So that's now creating that switch. And if I get a list once it's finished, if I go back to the view here so we see, you'll see those set NICs are now listed as enabled. But you don't see this random team appear here. Team 1 is the one we created earlier. There's no new team created here. It's abstracted away. You won't also see it in this teaming view here. It doesn't exist. It's just a Hyper-V construct. It's essentially the V switch. So where you will see it, if I do get VM switch, you'll see it here. There's our two. There's the one we created before, test switch in Hyper-V Manager. There's the one we just created, set switch. Now, if I want to get a bit more information on this, you'll see, what do we need to know? Well, it's got the load balancing algorithm is dynamic. It's switch independence using those two physical NICs. That's fine. If we want to administer this, at least as it stands today in Technical Preview 3, we simply run a couple of PowerShell commands, and that changes it now to Hyper-V port as the load balancing algorithm. I'm not going to go through all the load balancing algorithms today. You know, if you're interested, there's plenty of documentation on those. I'm just showing you how easy it is to actually create and administer. And that's the key difference today. And as we go forward, I'm sure the UI will start to reflect support of these and also Virtual Machine Manager. But that's a straightforward look at how the different approach. The key takeaway is we're doing it to enable the RDMA pass-through, so the RDMA convergence, but also that convergence of layers. We don't need that initial team. We can do it all in the Hyper-V vSwitch, which is much more scalable that way. So let me go back here. There we go. So to wrap up the conversion network in RDMA as a summary, it's allowing you to utilize the RDMA functionality that would normally be exclusive on the NICs and allow you to utilize them in more converged scenarios, where in the past, in 2012 R2, that wouldn't be possible. So you can do RDMA failover, you can expose multiple RDMA NICs to the host or to guests, and the key one on the right-hand side is that performance. It's native performance, which is great. So another thing around performance is something called Packet Direct. And Packet Direct, if you think about the network driver interface today, NDIS, on Windows, it's essentially been around for a long time, and it's not changed drastically. And that relationship between drivers and hardware, it's fairly generic. But with Packet Direct, we're able to think, okay, well, is this going to be enough, this NDIS, is it going to be enough in its current form to allow us for the future to go to the 100 gig speeds that are on the horizon? You think, no, it's not. You think, well, who needs 100 gig? Well, there's appliances out there specifically, load balancers, firewalls need to handle a lot of traffic. Those kind of workloads can need incredible speeds. Think about our Azure load balancers and how much traffic is coming in and out of there across all of the different geographies. That's phenomenal. We need to be able to scale. And NDIS as a model doesn't scale to that. It's fine for everyday workloads, but we need to think differently. And when applications can start to understand the network stack and start to tell the network hardware what it needs more specifically, that can increase our performance and scale. And that's essentially what Packet Direct is. It's been around in a form in Linux for a while, the data path data kit, where Intel have done a lot of work, heavily utilized in appliances like load balancers, like firewalls, and so on, to drive that highest performance. And so essentially, this is an optimized transmission path and stack where the applications that are sending and receiving data are network aware, NIC aware, if you will. And they can start to integrate. And it's not going to be your everyday applications. It's going to be those more likely to be found as those kind of appliances that I mentioned earlier. So it's incredibly quick. It's, like I say, it's all focused on the application. And I've actually got a demonstration. My hardware is a little bit old. It's not most of the 10 gig NICs will support it, but in my environment, I'm not blessed with that. So I've got a video of somebody who does have hardware that can show you for that. So let me go into, just to show you the impact. Where are we here? Number 6. Oh. Here we go. So what we've got on the screen here before Greg gets too far into this is essentially he's going to log into a machine that's going to be received. It's going to have a perf trace on there and show you the traffic that's getting received, the packets that are getting received. He's then going to log into another machine, and he's going to trigger a load of UDP packets to hit that machine, and we'll see what that reflects like in the graph in perfmon. And then is going to turn on Packet Direct. And remember, this is just a feature and a capability we're working on to embrace what is in hardware for most 10 gig NICs. It's just with that, you're going to see incredible performance boosts. So there you go. We're at about 1.5, 1.6 million packets coming in. And that's based on the UDP packets that he's generating from that machine. It's fairly steady, but that's not using Packet Direct at all. So then when he goes to enable Packet Direct, so he has to stop that first, and then enable Packet Direct. So it's enabled, there we go. And he does actually restart the NIC just to make sure it's all fresh and ready to go. And then he starts sending the data, same source, but you'll instantly see doubled performance. Now this is just on a single NIC, single hardware, but if you imagine that in a scaled environment, that's going to have a significant impact. It's over double the performance. So for virtual appliances, for very network-intensive applications, this is going to be significant. But remember, it's for network-aware applications. It's not necessarily going to be for your everyday app that you've written in your environment. It might not be for your line of business apps, might not benefit. There are other technologies that would benefit that, but not necessarily Packet Direct. But it's just another indication of the kind of hardware integration we're building in the next release. Now, when it comes to SDN infrastructure, I want to focus in back on that network virtualization that I demoed before and some of the ways we're improving there. I talked about NVGRE briefly as an encapsulation and how we isolate those virtual networks, the blue and the red that we had, the Contoso, the Fabricam, and other networks that I showed you in the demo. But we realize that there's not just Microsoft platforms out there. Just like we're doing a lot of heterogeneous work with Linux and working closely with that community and Docker and so on, we realize that there are other encapsulation policies or encapsulation technologies out there. One of them that's arguably the most popular alternative, is VXLAN. VMware, with their Nisiro or their NSX technology, heavy user, Cisco also. And we want to make sure that we can integrate and interoperate with those environments, particularly if you're heterogeneous. So we now support in the platform the ability for you to use VXLAN as the encapsulation, as opposed to NVGRE. So again, integration, great. The Hyper-V vSwitch, same core functionality, but we're taking more from the learnings from Azure. So much so that the flow engine, how the traffic is traversing that Hyper-V vSwitch, is now the same as Microsoft Azure's. So it needs to scale in that environment, that's for sure. We can't have bottlenecks. And that's bringing that on-premises is a big thing, because in Azure, it's been tested at hyperscale. Battle-tested at hyperscale, and we're bringing it on-prem. Do you have to change anything? No, just there. And then from a protocols perspective, we talked about NVGRE, VXLAN, we talked about some of the others before when we were talking about OMI and WSMAN and WMI, but there's others as well as we start to think how we can interact with the network controller that I'm going to talk about shortly. REST APIs, JSON templates, SNMP for more regular, more traditional information on the network. So all of those are now becoming more and more of a bigger part of the overall SDN story. But I touched on this network controller earlier. It is without doubt going to be the most important part of the platform going forward in 2016. The network controller is this centralized, programmable brain in the center of the infrastructure for networking, because it controls and has the ability to control everything. It will control the physical switches through OMI. It will control your Hyper-V host, deploy virtual networks, deploy vSwitches, deploy whatever you want to deploy, firewall policies, and so on. It will control the top of rack switches. It will program your routers and your whatever you've got within the environment. It all runs through that network controller. And as a configuration guidance, you can deploy it as a single VM for a lab. And I would advise you, if you're going to think about deploying some of these SDN technology in a lab, wait until technical preview 4 for the Windows Server. Technical preview 3 is a little light on documentation. When you get to the network, you can read all about what it does. They just won't tell you how it does it. Wait till technical preview 4. You'll get it. It's not that far away. Wink for those on the video recording. and that's going to give you more insight into how it works. But essentially, it's going to give you that central point of control. You can deploy a single one as a lab. You can cluster it for redundancy, and that is a significant piece of guidance. You should be thinking about how you can make this as redundant as possible because it's such an important part and has so many controlling points. But what does it do? What does it control? We'll look at some of that in a bit more detail as we go forward. I touched on these APIs a bit early on. Southbound API is all about the network controller reaching out into your network and discovering stuff, whether it's your switches, whether it's the Hyper-V switch ports, just stuff that it can communicate with at the physical layer and to a certain extent the virtual layer. But then the northbound API is how you start to interact with it. So you can extract from the network controller information that you might want to include in a monitoring tool or something you want to fire off to configure something. As I said before, it's my ability to say, okay, I've got a PowerShell script, I'm going to run it against the network controller and deploy a load of firewall policies or software load balancer policies or whatever it may be. So the network controller is going to control all of that. It's that central layer from you as a management controller where you're using System Center to pull the strings on the network controller or where applications themselves are talking to the network controller to bring about change. And like I said, it can manage a whole host of stuff, whether it's Hyper-V VMs, vSwitches, network, physical network switches, gateways, teams, all sorts of stuff from the physical through the virtual. And so some of the other things it can do, and this is a bit of an eye chart, a bit of a reference chart, if you will, if you did want to see everything on a slide that the network controller can do, it's here. So it's managing the fabric, deploying IP, physical IPs, subnets, VLANs, if you will. It's the firewall management. And this is new in Windows Server 2016 as well. And I've not got to it yet in the slides, but it makes sense from a context perspective to give you some insight into it now. We are bringing to market a distributed data center firewall within the network controller and within the networking stack. So I'm able to essentially, through the network controller, deploy policies across my virtual infrastructure, either north, south, from hosts through guests, or between guests. I've got that flexibility. And it's taking advantage of the firewall capabilities within Windows Server, but centrally configuring and controlling all of those from a single place. So very powerful, and that's all included within Windows Server 2016. It's monitoring. If you want to get insight into that network infrastructure, the network controller is going to be the point at which your monitoring tools plug in. It goes and gets all the information from the relevant sources and provides that back. So if you're looking at something like an ops manager, there will be management packs that allow you to extract that information from here, but also SNMP data and so on. And it allows you to bring very visual maps and views of the infrastructure based on the connectivity that it discovers. So it allows you to start to build up this map and deeper insight into how all of these things are connected and how they can be independently affected by one another. So if you've got a faulty network, how does that impact the virtual networks that reside on that, for instance? Service chaining is another important one. If you've got an application, or if you've got a packet of data that needs to flow between multiple appliances for compliance, for instance, it needs to be scanned by this, needs to do this, and then it needs to go here. Service chaining and that allows you to define those kind of flows. So I could say, well, packets going this way need to go through this packet sniffer, then they need to go through that appliance, and then they can carry on from there. So again, you define all of those kind of experiences and policies within the network controller. And the load balancer is another one of those. We'll take that from Azure, thank you very much, and we'll give that to people who use it on premises. So just like the data center firewall, just like the network controller itself, this software load balancer has been taken from Azure and brought on premises within Windows Server. And again, it's not the network load balancer, it's not an evolution of NLB, it's not the brother of NLB, it's not anything of NLB. It's a new, battle-tested, run at hyperscale software load balancer from Azure that were given to you on-prem. So you can load balance your applications, your workloads, whatever it may be. And again, it's controlled by the network controller. The virtual network management that you saw me do before through VMM, that would have been orchestrated through the network controller. I still would have done the same things through the UI. VMM would have just told the network controller, make it so, and off you go. And then the gateways. So managing those site-to-site gateways, those site-to-site VPNs, those connectivity between your sites. The key takeaway from this slide is the network controller does a hell of a lot of stuff. It does a lot of stuff. And it enables you to control those different elements from physical to virtual. And that's important from a central place. And because it's got that REST API, it can be automated as well through your common automation mechanisms. And then we wrap up to the final bit, which is the functions. I've already talked about some of these functions already. These are things that you would typically have as appliances within your environment, like a firewall, like a load balancer, and so on. Well, these are things that we can virtualize now. So things like the site-to-site gateway, the software load balancer, the data center firewall component, we can virtualize all of those. So when we think about some of the common ones, antivirus is a good one. Agentless antivirus existing in appliance, great, we can do that. We don't provide one for that. We don't provide one out of the box in Microsoft, but there are third parties that will be able to provide those appliances. We do provide the site-to-site gateway through the Windows Server Gateway. We do provide a load balancer, the software load balancer I just referenced. And these are essentially, usually, as I said, performed by hardware, but we can virtualize them. And they are becoming a brand in the market. VMware, you look at their VMware marketplace, and there's tons of appliances out there that you can purchase, or some of them free, to do this kind of stuff. But in an enterprise, in a production environment, you're going to look to those vendors, the partners that you work with, to provide those appliances, either hardware-based or software-based. And we're working with them as well. But like I say, we are providing some of them in the box from our experience with Azure and bringing them on-prem. The nice thing about the solution with Microsoft is they're all plugging into that network controller. So it's all a standardized mechanism for you to manage and control them all. So I'm going to quickly flick through these. So that load balancer, for reference, I've already talked a little bit about it already, but this has come from Azure. It's hugely scalable because of that, where it's been with Azure. I mean, literally, there are software load balancers out in Azure now, load balancing billions of flows of traffic. And we think, okay, it's doing all right. It's handling it. Let's use it. Let's bring it on-prem. And so we'll use it and give it to you in Windows Server. One of the nice things about the feature of the software load balancer, aside from the fact, yes, it's built in, it's flexible, it gives me support for NAT, it's easy to use, easy to manage, I can apply the policy through the controller, all of that is great stuff. But from a technology perspective, from a feature and performance perspective, this thing called direct server return, which is the bottom bullet there, is a cool way for me to say, okay, I've got an application, I'm a user, I'm going to access my app, it's going through the load balancer. Unbeknown to me, I access the web page or whatever the app is, and the load balancer, instead of the next time I access is just sending me off, load balancing me to the other web front end or whatever, it gives me a direct connection. As soon as that first connection is established, I've got a direct server connection now between me and my endpoint. I don't need to go through the load balancer again, which frees up the load balancer to load balance other stuff, and it gives me a focused experience and improved performance and scale. So very clever stuff, but it's, again, driving higher levels of performance with the load balancer. And I mentioned this firewall before. So the ability for me to provide a more secure environment for the infrastructure, for me to say, okay, I want to make sure that VM to VM traffic can be isolated where appropriate, VM to host traffic or VM through host traffic can be isolated, and I want to do that through policies that I define through the network controller. So I could define that programmatically through a JSON document or PowerShell, or eventually through the UI when that comes to bear in Virtual Machine Manager. Define that policy and say these VMs can or can't communicate. They should be able to communicate whatever it may be. So it's a five-tuple stateful firewall. The usual stuff, source and destination ports, source and destination IPs. But this gives you enough control and centralized control to really start to lock down communication between your different pieces of the infrastructure. And as I said, managed by the network controller. When it comes to diagnosing it, that's another important part. What if something goes wrong? What if a policy you've applied isn't quite having the effect? Well, the network controller, as I said, extracts so much information and insight into what's going on in the environment that you'll be able to go to that one-stop shop and identify what's going on. And I can configure these firewall policies, the vSwitch port. It doesn't matter where the VM lives or where it goes. The policies I apply to a VM will follow that VM across the infrastructure, across the data center. So again, I've got that control and that management that's very important. And that brings me to the end. I'm more or less on time. I apologize for my demo not quite working before, but we got there, out of context, but we got there. There's lots of useful resources. You can get the preview. Now, that link there, the Windows Server 2016 preview, if you click it today, you'll get TP3. If you click it in a couple of days, anyway, you can explore the documentation, provide feedback to the team. this is complex stuff, don't get me wrong. I mean, the RDMA, the network virtualization, it's all very complex, especially if you've come from a very traditional networking background. It's almost easier to start from scratch with no knowledge than try and apply it to what you previously knew. But work through it and provide feedback to the team. They want to hear from you. And there's lots of useful reading on TechNet as well. We are working on more Microsoft Virtual Academy courses on networking that will be able to provide you a lot more insight into how this stuff works and demonstrate some of the stuff. If I'd have demonstrated the network controller and a load balancer and stuff today, it would have just been lines and lines of PowerShell. So I thought, you know what, after lunch, I'll hold you back from that. But there are some videos online where you can start to see some of it. But it's long JSON documents configuring stuff very quickly and automatically, and you don't learn a great deal. So that's why TP4 will give us a little bit more GUI love for those that like that. So complete your evaluation. I know it's very cheesy to say, but we really do read the feedback. It's important to us because if you think, well, I didn't learn a great deal, let me know because I'd change it completely if that was the case. It's a tough topic because it's hard to find that balance of what's new for people and what's not. But again, we really do benefit from what you've got to say and let us know. And you can win a prize, which is obviously the side benefit. Obviously, just making you feel good about is the main benefit of filling out an eval, not winning a prize. Thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And any questions, come on up. I'm happy to chat for a little while and I'll clear up my stuff and get out of the way. And it'd be good to hear from you. So thank you very much for your time. Thank you. My house in Budapest, my hidden treasure chest, golden grand piano, my beauty focused EOU.